Why only earth and uncut stones for construction of altars? Was that meant only for the wilderness? Paul were to point out that it's not reasonable to conclude that this is reference only to the wilderness. It was meant for the time after entrance into Canaan. This was the kind of altar that was to be used. In fact, he says when it was given in Exodus 20, right at Sinai, there's no thought at that point of 40 years in the wilderness. The golden calf apostasy had not occurred. The law is being given at Sinai. The anticipation is that soon Israel will come into the promised land. So that he says what strikes us is, in the Exodus 20 passage, is that there were strong regulations on how the altar was to be built, the place it was to be located, which was to be removed from arbitrary choice of the people. Notice it says that in all the places where I record my name, I will come unto you. So the regulations on how it was to be built, the place it was to be located. But it gives no indication that only one place was to be used. And certainly it's clear that the practice during the time of Samuel corresponded to that law. There's more than one altar. So, Howard asked the question, how then do we harmonize Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 12? Do we adopt Wellhausen's conclusion? There was a long period of development, originally multiplicity of altars, development into centralization of altars. Well, he says, the question is, does Deuteronomy 12 demand centralization? And to him, that's the crucial point. Does Deuteronomy 12 demand centralization? And in the discussion of that, verse 14 becomes really a critical verse. You read in verse 14, I'll preface it with 13, take heed to thyself, that thou offer not thy burnt offerings in every place that thou seest, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of thy tribes, there shalt thou offer thy burnt offerings. There shalt thou do all that I command thee. Not in every place, but in the place in one of thy tribes. He says you cannot stop with the first impression you may get from these verses. In one of thy tribes, Deuteronomy 12, 14, B'ahaz Shivateka. In one of your tribes. According to Hebrew usage, that does not necessarily indicate only one. Because frequently, this kind of an expression can have the same idea as the English word any. In any of your tribes. So that it could mean in any one of your tribes or in any number of your tribes. It's not explicitly clear. Now, what the Holward points out is the analogy with Deuteronomy 18:6. In Deuteronomy 18:6, you have the regulation. If a Levite come, and notice the King James translates this verse, from any of your gates, if a Levite come from any of thy gates out of all Israel, where he sojourned, and come with all the desire of his mind unto the place which the Lord shall choose, then he shall minister in the name of the Lord his God, as all his brethren the Levites do, stand there before the Lord. Now, the expression in the Hebrew is really identical with the difference of the main and the base preposition. Mea has she'areta, from one of your gates or from any of your gates. Well, the point is, the purpose is not a rule for a Levite coming from one particular gate, but for every Levite coming from any gate. If a Levite comes, any Levite, come from any of that gate. So that the expression can be translated permissibly either way, one of or any of. And depends to a large degree on the context of which meaning you're going to place on. But then you notice, getting back to Deuteronomy 12, verse 14, it says, in the place. Isn't that in the singular? If more than one place was meant, wouldn't it require a plural? In the places which the Lord shall choose. Well, again, not necessarily so. It may be, but not necessarily so. In Numbers chapter 16, verse 7. You read, in connection with the uprising, the rebellion of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram in the camp in the wilderness, you read, this do, take you censers, Korah and all his company, put fire therein, put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Lord doth choose, he shall be holy. Ye take too much upon you, ye sons of Levi. And Moses said unto Korah, hear I pray you, and so forth. Now the point is here, the man whom the Lord doth choose, the man, ha-ish, which the Lord doth choose. The phrase which follows is identical there. But it's the man, in the sense that the man is singular, but the question is if the office of priest and leader is to be confined to Moses and Aaron or extended to the 250. There's 250 people that are involved. So the choice is between two plurals. But the text says the man, singular. The meaning is clear in the context of Numbers. The men, whether two men or 250 men. The way of stating that is that the man whom the Lord will choose, but not necessarily exclusively only one man. Yeah. It's either Moses and Aaron, or all these 250 people that were seeking the same status as Moses and Aaron. It's going to be the man that the Lord will choose, but in the sense of more than one. Those will be the leaders. Now, I think exegetically you have to conclude on the basis of the expressions in the chapter itself that Deuteronomy 12 can mean one place and one tribe, or more than one place that the Lord will indicate in the land in any of the tribes. It can mean either. On the basis of the language used. So that really then Deuteronomy 12 says the same thing as Exodus 20 to 24. In Exodus 20 verse 24, in all the places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. additional factors which Holwerder says points in this direction are not in every place, but in the place. Not in every place, but in the place. Does that mean multiplicity versus centralization? He'd say, no, that's not the right way to put it. The question is not one or more, but whether the place is selected by human arbitrary means or by divine choice. Not in every place, but in the place. Is that multiplicity versus centralization? No. Question's not one or more, but whether the place is selected by human arbitrary means or by divine choice. That's the point. And at that point, there is consistency between Exodus and Deuteronomy. He also says that the motifs behind the specifications of Exodus 20 have been shown to have been prohibitions against precisely the kind of altar that existed in Canaan, that had been excavated. Israel was to have a distinctively different kind of altar than the heathen Canaanites were. Their worship was not to be confused with the Canaanite worship, but the point of the regulations there in Exodus is to make very clear that Israel's altar was to be distinctively different than the Canaanite altar. And he also says that Deuteronomy 12 says that all the offerings are to be brought at the chosen place or places. And then it is added, the whole family will appear with servants and Levites. Notice verse 18 of Deuteronomy 12. Thou must eat them before the Lord thy God in the place which the Lord thy God shall choose, thou, thy son, thy daughter, thy manservant, thy maidservant, and the Levite who is within thy gate. Now, what he points out is this. The whole family, with servants and the Levites, think of what that meant practically. For a city such as Dan, north of Galilee, 150 kilometers from Jerusalem. Minimally, three times a year at the feast. Plus, offerings at birth, free will offerings, other required offerings. The whole family was to make a trip to Jerusalem. Now he, in his article, discusses what this would mean in a European context, and it would be roughly an absence of a week, minimally. Be like us today going to Florida or something, or perhaps further, to make these required offerings. What about the Levites? If there were many families in the village, he could be on the road the whole year. Then the Holwerder says, why stay in the northern town? Why not just stay in Jerusalem? Meet them when they come. He says it's impractical. It couldn't be carried out. His conclusion is that Israel never had a law that bound the cult to one place, but always lived under a law that provided for local places next to the central sanctuary, originally at Shiloh, later at Jerusalem. That doesn't mean there wasn't a central sanctuary, and there wasn't primacy of sanctuary connected with the Ark and the temple. But not to the point of exclusiveness and illegality of any offering at any other altar or sanctuary. So he says what was regulated was the place where altars were to be built, not just arbitrarily anywhere, but at places that the Lord in some way made clear. how, by theophany or whatever, is not explicitly described, but it's restricted to places that the Lord in some way indicates. The material out of which altars were to be built was regulated, and the offerings that were to be brought were regulated. So that God provided for altars scattered. That doesn't mean there was an altar in every village or every few miles, just arbitrarily everywhere. Because in Deuteronomy 12, too, not 12, verse 2, but in Deuteronomy 12 also, it says in verse 21, if the place which the Lord thy God has chosen to put his name there be too far from thee, then thou shalt kill of thy herd and of thy flock which the Lord hath given thee as I have commanded thee, and thou shalt eat in thy gates whatsoever thy soul desireth. In other words, animals could be killed and eaten in places other than going to the sanctuary to slaughter animals. Distance might make that impractical. So it sounds like they weren't just everywhere throughout the land. There was some restriction in connection with the Lord's designation of certain places, but not restriction to a central sanctuary, with all other altars illegal. So that God provided many altars to keep his people from the temptation all around them, and to keep them in fellowship with himself in accordance with the provisions in the sacrificial system which he had made, without making that system almost impossible to follow because of the extreme distances of God. Now, basically, that's Hallward's view. I'd say that you find roughly the same position in Thompson when you read his commentary and in his introduction. You want also to see a very similar viewpoint, Manly, the book of the law that I've asked the grad students to read, has a whole chapter on this. And basically, he comes to this same conclusion. He says, as to centralization, the language used is capable of having this interpretation read out of it or into it. That's this language here. The real force of the contrast in Deuteronomy 12 is not between many Yahweh altars in one, but between those of the Canaanites to other gods whose name is to be destroyed, and the place where the name of Yahweh shall abide. It's not their number, but their character which is in question. Whether the words be read as pointing to one center or more than one, they do not exclude the possibility of other altars duly authorized. Indeed, the rule in Deuteronomy 16, 21, 22 contemplates the existence of such. In Deuteronomy 27, the erection of one is commanded. So it's not multiplicity of altars that is argued against in Deuteronomy. Another book, H.M. Siegel, The Pentateuch, Its Composition and Authorship, has a section on centralization of worship, page 87 and following. Now, I could read that, but I think our time's about up. Again, it's basically the same conclusion in Manly, Thompson, Siegel. I think that generally the view that is being followed today is that multiplicity of altar was not excluded in ancient Israel by the Deuteronomic legislation. Now, it seems to me, just to draw this to a conclusion, our whole introductory section, that there are three issues in Deuteronomic studies that are significant, on which, presently, there is a very solid orthodox counterpart to critical theory. The first is this whole structure of the book, and Klein's work and others with this treaty covenant analogy, I think, have given a good argument in connection with the integrity and unity of the book of Deuteronomy. over against critical theory. The second issue is this matter of centralization of worship, central to Wellhausen's view. I think these positions of Hallwarder, Thompson, Manley, and others face that issue and give an alternative position that puts the issue on quite a different perspective than Wellhausen does. The third matter that we can't discuss, and I can't get into it, it's complex and it's detailed. Is the matter of this so-called progression of law codes, J.E. code, covenant code, Deuteronomic code, holiness and priestly code, in other words, a sequence of law codes, with development and change in some kind of historical progression. Manley deals with that beautifully in this book, the Book of the Law, Studies in the Date of Deuteronomy. He points up numerous problems with that scheme of J, E, D, and T. It's simply a progressive development of successive codes. Now, that requires a detailed consideration of specific laws, how they're reflected in covenant code, how in Deuteronomy, how in the priesthood, and what conclusions you can draw from that. But Manley's discussion of that, I think, is an excellent response, so to speak, to this thing of Wellhausen. So that in those three areas, structure and integrity, centralization worship issue, sequence of code, within the last few years, comparatively speaking, there's been an enormous amount of work done from an evangelical perspective that I think is of great value in countering a lot of these positions that have dominated the field in the study of the Book of Deuteronomy. Well, our next class hour, we get into Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 32 to 40. I think it'd be good if you'd